Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. Sure. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, best-selling author of The Little Red Book of Selling.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute. And this is Sell or Die. Real-world sales talk, no bullshit, no tricks.
We're interviewing the best minds of selling and personal development. If this is your first time listening, make certain that you subscribe on iTunes so you can listen to past interviews and topics, because every one of our shows is killer.
We're taking your sales questions. Send them to us on Twitter, at Gittimer, or at Jen in a New York Minute, or just email them to us. You know what? If you want to advertise on the show, you can do that too. Just email your questions and inquiries to sellordie@gittimer.com.
Or send large checks to Gittimer, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28203. So reading...
Actually, as a teaser to the show, they could even pay by credit card.
That's true. Reading every single one of your questions, because there's a ton of them, the man behind the glass, our producer, the great, the handsome, the haircut, Doug Branson.
Oh, hello. Hi, Doug. Jeffrey. Hello, Jennifer. A reminder to our listeners, you can listen to us live on Wednesdays at blogtalkradio.com/sellordie. And make sure, like Jeffrey said, subscribe to us on iTunes. Just search Sell or Die. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review. Help great salespeople just like yourself find our podcast. Jeffrey, Jennifer, what's going on in your sales world?
Well, this week's going to be a pretty busy week for me. I'm traveling out to Victoria, Canada, to do a live seminar out there for a bunch of insurance people. Jen, where are you this week?
I am currently in New York laying the groundwork. I have two classes coming up at the end of this month in New York. They're public classes, so anyone who's listening that wants to attend, it's all about how to use LinkedIn to make more sales. And they'll be live in New York.
Coming up, you know, we have an amazing show today. We have the great Ben Prusky, who's going to talk about water bottles and credit cards. And Ben is an expert at both.
That's a good tease.
But I think that you're going to get a lot out of this. If you have a credit card or you process a credit card, today's information is critical to your wallet and to your bank account.
Plus, we're back with our weekly agenda, giving you tips and strategies that you can use this week to increase your sales.
Okay, so let's get into it. It's time to sell or die. So let's get over to Reddit and get some of your sales questions and comments. Doug, who's first?
First up, Reddit user HGW09 asks, how do you handle starting each year at zero? For my profession, sales included, each year you start back at zero, and often you complete financially well, or your whole financial well-being is tied to your activity that year. How do you best handle this? Also, what steps do you take to make sure you're growing yourself and your wealth, even if each year is an unknown and you start at zero?
Don't you have past customers? Don't you have relationships that you've built that you can have January as coffee with my customers month and either get referrals or get new business? It would seem to me as though starting at zero, if you start at zero in January, you start at zero in December the same way, unless you're trying to build up points or build up your sales for your quota or your whatever, that sales plan that your boss has.
You know, I've worked with some companies in the past where they have quotas for the whole year, the calendar year. Yeah. And as the salesperson completes the quota, let's say they're at 50% of it, and then they get to 51, at that break, they get a bigger commission. So I get what this person is saying is that, you know, perhaps at the beginning of the year, they start at that low tier where maybe they're making much less commission. And knowing that, you just have to plan for it. And, you know, what are you doing in October, November, December of the prior year so that your January is rocking it? If you're just starting to think about it in January, it's probably too late.
I want to add one other thing. You better think ethically with the advent of the exposure of Wells Fargo and the either incompetent twit senior management or the unethical people that the senior management knew about but slid under the cover, I think that you're going to have to deal with sales goals in a real different way, a very specifically different way that allows a salesperson not to feel pressured into making some kind of an ethical error in order to be able to achieve the goal. Like a lot of guys, for example, they have their quota is $10,000 a month. So they get to $12,000 a month and they sandbag 3,000 more sales to the next month. So they make sure they can hit their quota for each month. The sales manager, the sales leader has to make the sales goal achievable in an ethical way and doable in a way that it makes profit for the company and keeps the salesperson without them feeling oppressed or pressured to do the wrong thing.
And for those that don't know, he was referencing this latest story on Wells Fargo. They fired, over 5,000 employees who were connected in schemes to inflate sales numbers by setting up false accounts, moving people's money around without their permission. A lot of ethically, just plain wrong and some ethically fuzzy stuff going on there.
Not like 100 accounts.
I have to say, for those that don't know,
you're living somewhere to...
I appreciate you listening to our podcast and living under a rock
to get this news update.
Hey,
I don't even watch. I don't watch the news. I don't listen to the news, and I know about it.
Hey, listen, Leno. Jay Leno had a famous segment based on what everything that people don't
that's
know.
That's true.
He went on the street
that was
and found
funny.
Out. So,
that's true.
It was a good segment.
I will tell you that this is going to change the way sales are quoted. The sales quotas are handed out possibly forever, but certainly for the next decade. Every sales manager.
I read that they're getting rid of their quotas now on this.
That's Wells Fargo. What about the other million companies in this country?
Oh, yeah. This is going to start a huge trend. I agree.
Yeah. And so I saw some idiot today saying Wells Fargo is going to rebound in 2017. Like, dude, they're not going to rebound for a decade. Mm-hmm. They've already fired 5,000 salespeople. How many do you think are just going to flat ass leave?
Well, it all goes back to how, even though I think a lot of these people, I may be speaking out of turn here, but I don't think that a lot of these people had direct consumer access, but the fact that they broke trust in this way breaks trust for all of the consumers for Wells Fargo.
That every Wells Fargo customer is looking for a new bank, or at least they're looking to make certain that what they have there is guarded and safe. Mm. I'd be calling my banker if I banked
there. And if their banker has left, they know why, and they're definitely looking for a new bank.
Yeah.
And they're not going to go, and their banker's not going to call up and say, hey, remember me? I'm the guy that stole your money and put new accounts up so I can I have your business again?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I don't think those 5,000 salespeople are definitely not going to get a job in banking. I think they're going to get a job like in dog catching, or something equally as horrible.
All right. Next question from Reddit comes from Narcatus. Narcatus writes, "I'm curious to know what your morning routine looks like on a typical workday. I find that a good morning routine can really set the workday up for success, especially in sales. How do you guys get ready for the day?
Get up. Get out of bed, drag the comb across my head. Doo, doo.
That must hurt without any hair.
It does hurt, but yeah, that worked 25 years ago. No longer operative. I think that my morning routine has been pretty much the same for a long, long time. I get up and I do something. I write or I read. I try not to do email. My very first thing, I try to do something more productive than that. Sometimes I fall into the email trap, but the bottom line is I try productively not to. When I take a shower, which I do daily, I walk out of the bathroom mirror. I smile.
Thank you for doing that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I smile at the bathroom mirror because it has my goals written on it. So I see my little post-it goals here every single day. And I make certain that I'm looking at myself and telling myself I'm going to have a great day. So I self-talk equals self-performance. And then I try to have the least caloric breakfast on the planet, but it doesn't always work out that way.
Well, I start my morning with Death Wish coffee.
Oh, so do I. In fact, I have a cup right now. Pardon me while I slurp.
And I wake up and read something, or I wake up and write something, or I wake up and work out. It depends on what I've planned to do the night before, but the key for me is planning to do it the night before. And sometimes that's scheduling and signing up for a workout class, because I know if I sign up, I'll go. Now that we have this new dog, I wake up way earlier than I ever thought I would to walk her. And sometimes it's like 4 a.m. And I think about what I'm going to accomplish that day. And I have my list of the 3 things that I need to do today.
I make my list also. I'll either text myself at night before I go to sleep, so it's top of my pile, or I have something written down in a Word file on my computer.
All right, last question. Then we're going to get to Ben. Seriously, Hodor writes, I work as a salesperson for an integrated technology dealer, basically pulling Cat 5 and installing technology like projectors, video conferencing, smart hubs. We can work with new builds or with remodels. How have you found success getting on bid lists? What resources do you use to find and get on them?
Every industry has publications that will lead you to a bid list. You have to go research your own industry. There are papers, there are industry magazines, industry newsletters, industry blogs, LinkedIn groups. You have to dig and you'll find them. They're not hard to find. And once you find one, you'll find 10. Everybody knows everybody else's bid list.
Why don't you just ask some of your current customers what list they would use if they were putting out a bid?
Bingo.
I mean, if they like you, they should want to tell you.
In the amount of time it took you to write this question, you could have found 5 bid lists, I think.
Hey, thanks for submitting your question.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Thanks for submitting your question.
All right, Jen, you are in New York City, and you are sitting next to someone.
You're in New York City, and you're being nice to me?
You are sitting next to someone very special. Tell us about him.
I'm here in the office of Ben Prusky. He's the CEO of Freedom Merchants, a merchant services company, and he is a major thought leader, and not just thought leader, but actual person who does stuff and gets it done in the merchant services world. And according to your website, Ben, the company you run provides payment technology solutions to enable businesses, nonprofits, and any person or organization to accept credit card payments from their customers in an efficient, cost-effective way using every technology method available. So, Ben, you must love technology and data.
I love technology and data.
Tell us about that.
Well spoken, Ben.
So I guess it started, you know, in undergraduate, I had I studied computer science, and I had a couple internships where we were working with large scale databases, Oracle. I essentially taught myself Oracle when I was working at Lockheed Martin. And, I like taking large amounts of data and working with it in order to find some kind of meaningful, actionable, trends that someone can use. So when I was thinking about this company, which I was thinking about for a couple of years before I actually started the company, I figured that if I just put myself in the middle of a data flow, which there's a ton of data in credit card processing land, I'd be able to figure out something to do with it. And very quickly, I realized that we have a particular a lot of merchants have multiple locations. So initially, our strategy was to take the data that a CFO or a controller or an owner would need managing multiple locations, and to give that CFO or controller some kind of insight that they could use with it. And that has sort of evolved, and we've gone, you know, in a lot of different directions from there. But that was the original thing. But yeah, I do like data a lot. It's factual. I like sorting it and resorting it and doing double sorts and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
How do you feel that's changing the way people sell?
The way people sell, well, I mean, at a general level, it's really hard to sell if you don't have stats to back your stuff up. And yeah, you know, a lot of people can, you know, have said, oh, well, there's statistics and something or other. There's some kind of cliche about statistics and stuff. But if you don't have numbers to back up your arguments as a salesperson, I don't think you're going to get very far. I don't think anyone, you know, you can smile and they can like you personally. But if you don't have some kind of data point to hang your hat on, as a general salesperson, I just don't think you're going to get very far.
Yeah, but the word data didn't even exist 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, being able to access 100% of your information online didn't exist 10 years ago either.
True.
But now it does. I'm not saying that a person can't sell without data. I mean, at the end of the day, they need to know you and like you and mm-hmm. believe that your product is going to be, you know, at least as good as the market equivalent. But I don't know. I'm a big fan of data, and I buy from people who present me with data. So if you're selling to someone who likes data, they're going to want to hear data, in my opinion, and not going to want to.
Of course.
Just, you know.
So if they're like a chief financial officer or an accountant.
Right. The data is proof.
Right. Yes. Yes. In my sector, you know, financial services and technology space, data matters a lot. Information in general, okay, not just specific little data elements, but information, you know, things that just make things more efficient. But that's you know, that's us. That's not we're not selling to you know a generic, you know. Someone in the sectors that we're going after, that's what they care about in general. Some people just care about price. But, you know, things that we do help drive price down from a data standpoint for CFOs, helping minimize chargebacks, helping make sure things get the lowest credit card processing rate by entering, you know, certain information. So I don't want to go too far into the data stuff, but, you know, that's some insight on there for me.
And what about technology? How is that changing the way you sell?
The way we sell? Well, for us particularly, technology, there's so much innovation in our space. So we're in the credit card process. We're smack in the middle of Apple Pay, in the middle of Samsung Pay, in the middle of chip and PIN, the entire migration that the United States has just embarked on, that Europe has already done, and Asia, for the most part, has already done. So technology is affecting how we sell because we have to just be aware of so many different technologies in our own industry. And we have to be able to speak to it to everyone we talk to in every sector. You know, there's different tools that we use, technology tools that we use to manage our company operations, but technology-wise, we're touching technology every single day, literally every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Different databases, different hardware that integrate that works with different phones. Different software that talks to other software that we developed language translation tool between those two software elements for customers that need to retrieve, you know, past transactions and stuff. So technology for us has affected how we sell, frankly, just because there's so much technology in our industry.
Mm-hmm.
The tools themselves that we use, you know, that's, you know, a different question, but not where most of our thought process is relating to technology. In fact, I mean, hardware, software, we're in the middle of all of that. So,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
So let's go back to data.
Yeah.
What are some of the best practices for using data to sell to a potential client?
To a potential client, number one, we have to have information regarding sort of the competitive landscape for their, what are their competitors doing? What service offering that we provide, that our core business is, the credit card processing stuff, you know, that their competitors may be getting, that they themselves may not be getting, what online reporting tools that we can give them access to they may not be using or have access to right now. So most importantly, in our particular industry, what information they need that they aren't getting currently in order to help them win chargebacks. Chargebacks for most merchants represent the greatest drain on fees. Losing chargebacks for any number of reasons. The biggest one being just not getting the paperwork or not getting the information, or not having entered the information properly. But if a merchant that isn't using us can fix possible lost chargebacks, it saves them way more money than just lowering their rates a little bit can do, because there's only so much you can lower someone's rates. But if someone has a chargeback issue and we can fix that, that you're talking about massive amounts of savings. You're talking about, I had a retailer up in on the Upper East Side of Manhattan that lost a $7,000 chargeback because they didn't have the right information at the right time to defend against a chargeback, where there was a window of time that they had to refute the chargeback allegations, for lack of a better word, and they lost that chargeback a massive amount of money. I had another retailer also in Manhattan, a luxury handbag retailer, have a $5,000 chargeback, similarly, because they didn't have the right data that they needed.
This is when they weren't working with
you. They were not a customer of ours. Uh-huh. Both of those situations were not customers of ours. They were using a generic process. They were using Stripe, because it was e-commerce process. They were using Stripe, which is well known in the e-commerce space, and Stripe was non-existent in helping them win the chargeback, get them the information they need, and frankly, just respond in a timely manner or pick up answer the telephone. On top of all of that, Stripe would not educate these two merchants about best practices for how to avoid this stuff in the future. This is a true story. These are actual customers of ours. And they're happily satisfied customers of ours.
But it's interesting. You use their data to show them how you can help them.
Yeah. Those two companies would have, $7,000 for a retail store is a lot of money to lose. $5,000 for a retail, it's real money.
Yeah.
You put that on a monthly basis, you're talking about $450 a month effectively, or $650 a month. And that's real cost.
Yeah.
So it's not just our contention, it's our reality that the data that we transform for our customers and package them in a way that they can digest helps them win chargebacks. The fact that we send them, people who get chargebacks, an email on the 15th and the 30th of each month helps them win chargebacks and not have chargebacks fall through the system that they didn't respond to.
Does the chip help?
So the chip helps in the retail environment only. The chip has no relevance for in e-commerce land, but in the retail environment, the chip absolutely helps. And just so you guys know, there are plenty of ways with a non-chip card to conduct fraud if someone wanted to. With a chip and a terminal that is programmed to read that chip, because not all terminals right now are, even though it's a mandate. And in October of this year, it'll be a law. And then in gas stations in October of next year, it'll be a law for them. But the chip absolutely helps, Jeffrey, and it helps in 99% of situations. But the fraudsters are developing new ways to use and to tweak that, to tweak the chip. So we're seeing occurrences of fraud and chargeback even in chip cards right now. In unusual situations. I don't want to get into the details of that, but yeah, the chip is a big step forward for both merchants. It's a little bit of an aggravation for the merchants to re-outfit their hardware, but if you can spend $350 or $300 for a new machine and avoid $4,000 a year in chargebacks, that's money well spent.
So Ben, your company sells services for the customer.
Yep.
That are both customer facing behind the scenes, like reporting data type stuff.
Yep.
And then their customer facing, right?
Yeah.
So how their customers would check out, like checkout pages, consumer
yep.
facing, right?
Yeah.
How do you approach those two differently from a sales perspective? So do you use them in different situations, or what do you do in your sales process that's different?
Well, so for the consumer facing checkout pages, people are very, very interested in good design. And that, from a selling perspective, will lots of times trigger and get us the sale.
So are you like showing them what it would? I don't want to give away your secrets.
Yeah, we show them past checkout pages. Occasionally, we'll on spec develop a checkout page for someone so they can actually see their checkout page ahead of signing up with us as a customer, which has been very, very helpful. It's also helpful because even though they may not decide to buy right then and there, they're knowing that the page has already been done, like lets them a month later, 2 months later, be like, you know what? I'm ready now. Can we turn that thing on? And I'm like, no problem. Whoa. Let's just get your tax ID and some basic business information and get going. Where it's more our customers using the data for their own purposes and stuff. The design and user interface, some of that stuff we don't have control over because we're relying on some third-party databases that we don't manage or oversee. Mm. We can use and manipulate the data and sort the data and generate reports and things like that, but we can't control the interface. The heavy users of our information, if something doesn't have the best user interface, the best graphical whatever, they'll survive. It's the information that they want and need that is the most important to them. So to our end buyer, people deciding whether or not they want to buy with us, the design aspect is very, very important. It's probably the most important thing. And the data is of secondary thing. The costs are also of secondary things. When they see the design, they'll ask like, okay, how much does this cost? But, frankly, they're already sold. So
that's pretty neat.
Ben, is it tougher to make one sale over the other, the back end versus the front end sale?
I'd say it's tougher. We have an easier time actually closing the back end sales and sort of, people who have real specific needs, like they've got 5 restaurants and 2 event hosting companies and, they have multiple needs and multiple users at their company. We actually have a better time, frankly, with that customer segment than with your plain vanilla, someone that just needs a checkout page or someone that maybe was already using Square or PayPal or one of our many merchant services competitors, First Data, Global Payments. So the more complicated the situation, frankly, the better that we do in general, on a relative basis. But someone that sees our checkout page and knows that they can turn it on at any time with a little bit of business information, that's not that hard of a sale either, but they're not always ready to buy, and get sign up, which is fine. That's why we have a pipeline. We have multiple channel partners who send us referrals of varying degrees of hotness, for lack of a better word, all the time. But to answer your question, Doug, yeah, we have an easier time with the more complex sales where the needs are more complex. And I think that's a function of just our competitors in our space. We've a million, there are a million merchant service company, not a million. Okay. Let's just call them a couple hundred merchant services company around the country. And, it's very, very hard to get anyone competent. And I would argue it's impossible to get someone with the level of competency that our company has. From our growth perspective, maybe that's a blessing and a curse at the same time, because maybe we're a little too good and that, makes us not, cookie cutter this stuff a little too much, but as much as we should. But we like solving problems and we like evolving as a company. I mean, we're building stuff now that we never would have thought of a year ago. Wow. Plain and simple. So
how do you adjust your communication from the complex sale to the front end sale that may not be as complex? How do you communicate differently with those two different types of clients?
That's a great question. Normally I take a deep breath and it's kind of like Sylvester Stallone in the movie Over the Top, where he turns the hat around to become like a different person. I take a deep breath and I smile and I basically dumb it down to sort of, 2 or 3 key selling points. hey, you're going to love this. You know, I play on emotion. You're going to love this. The checkout page, you can send it out. It's pre-populated. You can keep an open invoice. I keep it real simple and focus on sort of lowest common denominator items that would appeal to that customer, prospective customer demographic. I mean, we're selling to pretty you know, sophisticated business owners all around, but I dumb it down. I don't talk about, you know, all the things that we get into with, you know, our enterprise
you would
clients
lose
and stuff.
Them.
Yeah. I would
makes
lose
sense.
Them. One of those lowest common denominators is, hey, we'll save you money. I mean, everyone loves to hear we'll save you money, but we don't always save people money. And, you know, and that's okay. We won't go to rock bottom for someone that needs a complex need. But yeah, so.
Would you rather sell a new business or an existing business?
Great question. I actually prefer to sell existing businesses because it gives us something to compare against. We prefer to sell existing, but you would think new businesses are easier because they don't have their system set up and whatever, but there's a lot of training with a new business just on basic merchant account fundamentals, you know, payment fundamentals. We really like working with experienced CFOs, people who have gone through pain processes with our competitors, with First Data, with Global Payments, with Mercury, with, you know, the point of sale companies. We love cleaning up the mess of other people. Love it.
All right, so let's talk about you for a minute. Tell us your story.
Oh, I thought you'd never ask. My story
we
is...
We only have an hour, so speed it up.
Okay. So real quick, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia on the Main Line, went to University of Pennsylvania, did a dual degree there in engineering and Wharton undergrad. It's called the Management and Technology Program. Happened to be one of four people at the school that got awarded a full scholarship based on all around, you know, goodness, not by the university, but through an outside foundation. Graduated, went to, did a couple years in investment banking in New York at Bear Stearns, working on large cap IPO, M&A and IPOs and stuff like that. After a brief period working at an investment firm, started my first web software development company with two other partners, and we were building custom software for all kinds of businesses. We had offices in New York and Philadelphia. And that was during sort of what I call internet bubble number one. And we were similar to a Sapien, a Cyent, you know, Proxicom, IXL, Razorfish, you know, sort of like the first evolution of full-scale digital marketing agencies, but heavy on the, you know, with the focus on web development. Mm-hmm. After that experience, I realized that one thing that lacked was recurring revenue. We would build these, you know, we would get paid, you know, we would have multi-$100,000 contracts with end customers. And when the contract was done, you know, maybe we'd do a little bit of web hosting and stuff like that, but there was no ongoing revenue stream. So I was obsessed with finding a business, my next business to start, would have recurring revenue. And I quickly settled on merchant services, but I didn't initially start the company right away. I worked for 3 years in San Francisco as the director of operations and finance to help rebuild a company called SoftCoin. So we turned that company around, we recapitalized it, we took on new venture capital from Greylock, and the managing partner there was the same managing partner that invested in LinkedIn and I think Facebook as well, a guy named David Z. So he was very instrumental in helping us rebuild that company. So after 3 years there, I moved back to the East Coast specifically in order to start this company that I've got now, which I've had since 2004. On a personal level, I just got married recently. I got married in June to my wonderful wife, Kelly Prusky, who has taken my last name and let go of her three-name Brazilian last name. We're very happy. We live in New York. We've got a little dog named Fluffy. And
how masculine.
Yeah. So
I want to interject one thing. IXL was based in, had a big acquisition in Charlotte.
Yep.
One of my real good friends caught a windfall. I mean, a huge windfall. Cashed out for like 20 million chips.
I believe that.
And that was, those were in the day. They had a corporate policy. They wouldn't take a website for under $500,000.
Yep.
The same website you can now build for about $150.
Yep. You're
scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's exact. Everything you just said is accurate and real and reflective of reality. And
technology eats companies. The same way it builds them, it eats them.
Yeah. Okay. And where we fit in, by the way, with IXL, their $500,000 minimum, we picked up from there. So we would do like the $200,000 project or $300,000 project. And we were wanting to be like your friend that got gobbled up by IXL, but we
missed the gobble.
Just a little bit late to that party.
All right, so back to you.
Yeah.
You're very involved in the environmental community.
Yes.
I've noticed, like, if I have a plastic water bottle, I'm shunned in your mind.
Yeah.
How did you get involved, and what drives you to do that?
Yeah, it's great. It's a great question. So environmental, the environment, you know, area is a huge part of my life. I'm on the board of two different nonprofits relating to that, the Clean Air Council and the Manhattan Solid Waste Advisory Board. I got into it because a high school buddy of mine actually is a staff attorney at the Clean Air Council. And as I would spend time, you know, hanging out with him and catching up with him over dinner, he would point out to me things that I had never thought of, like the complete lunacy of plastic straws and the complete lunacy of getting a plastic bag at CVS to carry if you buy a thing of toothpaste, which is already in a box and is already in a plastic thing. So one by one, slowly, he would share with me things that he was observing, you know, as a full-time active staff attorney at the Clean Air Council. Things like truck idling. You know, there's a law that trucks aren't allowed to idle past 3 minutes. So I started to frankly buy into what he was talking about, but I started to look at it from just a logical level. Yes, I do love planet Earth, and I do think it's the only Earth that we got. I think it's going to be a long, long time before we're colonizing Mars or things like that. I think it's the only planet we have. We got to take care of it. And frankly, I just don't think that the habits that people are in make sense with the reality of us having one planet. So I actively talk to all of my friends and it's working. So when I tell them not to take plastic bags, I'll have someone text me a year later being like, I'm so glad you told me about that. I just want you to know I rejected a plastic bag in London, or I rejected a plastic bag in, you know, Miami, or Ben, you wouldn't believe it. Like, this city doesn't even allow plastic bags, or they charge me 10 cents. You know, your thing is working. Cause we're trying to, I'm very instrumental in helping to get New York City a plastic bag fee of 5 cents that all consumers will have to pay that will go to the merchants. But I think logically, and you know, it just doesn't make sense to me. So it's not like I'm sitting there physically hugging trees. I just recognize, you know, it's going to be, I don't want to colonize Mars personally. I don't want to go there. I got no interest in it. I'd like to stay here, and I'd like everyone to just, you know, live efficiently.
How do you sell someone on not using a plastic bag? Everything is sales.
Great question. And I actually, how do I do it? And when do I do it? I actually do it on almost a daily basis. So when I go to the grocery store, I'll do it a couple different ways. But if it's, I've asked someone that's in front of me that has one item, like a box of Cheerios, I will tell them, I'll be like, listen, if you don't take that bag, I'll give you $1 not to use that plastic bag. And they've looked at me like I'm absolutely nuts, and they've looked at the cashier and they realize what I'm trying to do, just to minimize the plastic bag's usage, and they'll then hand the plastic bag back to the cashier.
First of all, he's talking to a stranger in a grocery store in Manhattan
and offering the money.
Points just for that.
Right.
No, that's a five-pointer.
That's
big.
A five-pointer.
Yeah. sometimes if I've been, you know, at the gym working out and you know, my patience is not quite as if I'm not in full on sales mode, I will just loudly be like, "Oh man, you need a plastic bag for one thing." I'll just kind of say it loudly so everyone can hear me, and the cashier will then see it, and then I'll ask the cashier, because I'm more interested in actually the cashier's habits than the individual consumers. And then I'll ask them and be like, "Listen, why, you know, I notice you guys don't even ask them if they need a plastic bag for that one thing of Crest." And they say, "Oh, well, you know, we asked." I say, and I call the cashier out. I say, you don't ask, cause I just observed and you didn't ask. So, I try to do it in a nice way, but I've come to the conclusion that only by getting the votes that we need in city council, which we do, this is a city by city thing. You know, mandating it at the government level is the only way to solve this, because even people with good intentions may not know and they may not realize. And it's been proven in large cities like San Francisco, Seattle, you know, LA, a 5-cent fee, a 10-cent fee is enough to drive down plastic bag usage by 80%.
I can tell you this, that New York City and doing it a nice way are mutually exclusive in their terms.
I know. I know. But I do it because I just look, I can't live with myself without trying, without saying something. What Doug, to answer your question on the truck idling thing, my sales pitch is even different, and it works 100% of the time. With truck idlers, I'll knock on them, and I'll wear, you know, what I'm wearing to work, you know, either a suit or you know, just a button down shirt, and I'll knock and I'll say the truth, which is, "Hey, you know, I work about a block away. I've seen police officers give tickets of $500 to trucks that are idling past 3 minutes. So I'm not telling you got to turn your truck off, but just FYI, if you want to, you know, avoid getting that big fee, you know, just FYI." And I'll walk away. I'm not looking for any commitment from them. Within 5 seconds of walking away, I will hear the truck's engine go off 100% of the time.
Well, that's interesting. I think that mirrors what you try to do for your customers, incentivize your service by saving them money in the long run. But I think the plastic bag sale is actually more interesting because you are pointing out habitual things that consumers are doing or grocers are even doing, the whole idea of putting one item in a bag.
Yep.
And you uncover that for them, and they realize it, and then that gives you an opportunity to make an argument. Like they would not hear the argument until you uncovered their habit.
Correct. Identifying that kind of habit it's what I do all the time. And you know, even when friends of mine have personal habits that I think they should change. But Doug, to your point, yeah.
Present company excluded, of course, Ben, right?
Well, yeah.
One of the first things Ben ever told me was to stop buying water bottles at stores. Why would I just not have my own water bottle that could be refilled? And I thought, oh, wow.
Yeah, Doug, I mean, that's exactly right. That's what I do, you know, on the plastic bag front, just helping people identify habits that are getting them into trouble. On the business front, you know, a lot of businesses, small business owners, medium business owners, they're sitting on massive accounts receivable balances, outstanding accounts receivable, which is a fancy accounting word to describe money that people owe them. And our checkout pages enable these business owners to just send a very elegant link that their customers will see, and just it makes them feel good. And it's got the amount pre-populated. They can enter their information, and the business owner will eliminate the amount, all those funds that are sitting on people's books. We had a printing company that I'm friends with, that whose best friend owed him like $1,200. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's enough to be kind of annoying. $1,200 to a small printer is real money, and he owed it for 6 months. So we created a checkout page for this printer. I'm happy to give you the name. It's the Park Slope Copy in Brooklyn, and he sent the invoice to his friend, one of his best friends, with the amount preloaded, $1,200. The guy paid at 11 p.m. at night, and Park Slope Copy's account receivable balance drops by $1,200. It's beautiful. So, Doug, to your point, I like identifying people's habits on their environmental front and on the business front. Like, hey, you know, let's fix this. And I believe that people can change. I believe, you know, because I myself didn't know. It was only if Logan hadn't taken the time to educate me about all the things that I was doing wrong on the environmental front, or just unaware of. It's not, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known. So I'm just kind of passing it forward.
That's cool.
Last week, Ben, we had our show on customer service. Service is a big part of your business philosophy as well. Tell us about that.
My company and, you know, my leadership philosophy is all about customer service. If we get a call from a customer, that call is getting replied to or answered on the same business day, or at least notified, hey, we're going to have to research this. We'll get back to you tomorrow. You know, if we're not servicing the customer, I mean, it's a cliche to say, but someone else will. But more importantly, it's just we like to answer questions. We like people to have information. The more they know, the better they're equipped they are to be, you know, more productive business owners. So customer service, super important. We like to give straight answers. We're very, very clear when we don't know an answer. That we let people know, hey, listen, we don't actually know the answer to this. Give us about, you know, an hour or two. We'll look it up and get back to you. We give them specific times when we're going to get back to them. We actually pick up the phone. You know, we will proactively pick up the phone and call. We had a new customer of ours, a messenger company, who average transaction size is about $50. And we noticed on our dashboard reporting that they ran a $10,000 transaction the other day, and which is great. It's great for them. It's great for us. But it would trigger all kinds of red flags with our underwriting department. So instead of just, you know, not doing anything about it, we proactively emailed them, letting them know, hey, listen, let's get some details on that transaction so we can expedite it with our funding department, so that you're not sitting around waiting the thing. And in addition to the email, I had one of my colleagues just personally call the CFO of that company. It's a pretty big messenger service company in New York City. And the guy really appreciated being called, because, you know, emails can go into spam filters. They can not be read or maybe accidentally deleted. And that's 10 grand to that business. It's a big chunk of money to any established business. So customer service is my middle name. In everything I do, not just in work, but personally, you know, I'm active in a lot of different, you know, boards, like I mentioned, nonprofit boards, networking organizations. And I let everyone know, like, hey, you got to get back. You got to reply. You know, where's the reply? And I'm very we encourage honesty, that if we don't know, or if we can't get to it, or if we're tied up, just to, you know, have some kind of communication back. And I think universally our customers love us for that. That's why, you know, Jeffrey, you are the king of sales, the undisputed king of sales. And for us, you know, our sales force is really our customers. Our customers are by far our number one sales force. And it's because they're happy, ecstatically happy with the customer service. And, you know, we get some very funny reviews, like, who would think you'd be so happy with their merchant processor? Like, who even knows who their merchant processor is?
Right.
But that's what it's like with us.
Can you take a moment and reflect back a little bit? I'll even give you some time to think about it. If somebody said, Ben, what are your three or four keys for success? What would you tell them?
I've actually thought about that a lot. The other week I was talking to someone I was kind of mentoring. Number one is persistence. So not giving up, and just staying at something, you know, because you never know when something really, really big is going to hit. And in about a half an hour, I have a conference call with the end result of one of those really, really big things. We may be having a channel partnership with some company who actually reached out to us that has 35 million customers that, you know, we may be working with in some way, shape, or form. So persistence is the number one. Number two is always finding the positive things, the positive of any situation. It's hard to do, but it's always there, because even when you fail or whatever, you lose a customer, every single time. I've had this company for 12 years. Every single time We've lost our number one customers a couple of times because of factors outside of our control. Maybe they bring in a new CFO who wanted to bring in their own guy and he was set on that from the get-go. Maybe, you know, there's plenty of reasons why someone, why a merchant processor can lose their customer. Every single time we've lost our largest customer, which has happened a couple of times over the past 12 years, we wind up growing from it and getting even bigger from on every different metric possible. So the key is to always find the positives in something and in any situation professionally. I could think of a million within the last month. And then the third is which is, you know, I hate to say it's the most important, but we always look for the triple win. So we look for a win for our customers. We look for the win for our channel partners. Channel partners are very important to us. You know, related businesses that are serving the same customer base who know us on a, you know, repeated ongoing basis and are able to refer their customers to us and things like that. And then the win for us. So we're always about the triple win. We talk about the triple win, you know, and we identify what the value proposition is for the three partners. So we don't just say this is a win for you. We say this is a win for you. This is a win for us. And oh, by the way, this is also a win for your customers. And so those three elements: persistence, always finding the you know, the positive of everything. So an optimistic outlook and a positive outlook. And you know, thirdly is clearly looking and finding, you know, what the win-win or the triple win is.
Thanks again to the great Ben Prusky for joining us. You can learn more about his business at freedommerchants.com. Jeffrey, big data is here, and you either embrace it or you don't.
Is it my turn?
No, I guess so.
No, here, listen, big data is definitely here. Most people don't know what to do with it. I didn't even know that it existed, you know, until about 5 years ago. And now we're trying to mine our own data to use it to be more relevant and more helpful to our customers. I want to be able to pinpoint who they are and who they aren't. And I want to be able to communicate with them the things that they think they need or that they know they need or that I know they need. And we can do that with data.
Yeah, it's interesting how Ben uses data to win sales deals.
Ben is amazing at what he does. And I think that from a standpoint of the chip and credit card processing, that whole world is changing right now for us. You go to a store and some of them have the chip, some of them don't have the chip. You know, please use it, please don't use it, please remove your card, please don't remove your card. This whole world is changing and becoming more sophisticated by the minute. And Ben is at the forefront of it, and people need to pay attention to that message.
One of the things he said that I wrote down because I found it so interesting was the more complicated the data needed or the more complex the sale, the better we do. And I think it's because they make it digestible and easy for their consumers. And then he said, we like solving problems. So I want to challenge you. How often is it that the more complex the sale, the more times you win it?
And I think that it speaks to Ben in terms of his capability that they want the problems that other people are afraid of. And he will be a leader in the field for a long, long time as a direct result of that. So I want to take a brief pause from the show and talk about one of our favorite companies on the planet, the one, the only, Death Wish Coffee. It is by far the world's strongest coffee, made from the strongest possible combination of perfectly roasted beans.
They have 100% no bullshit money back guarantee, and apparently they're getting a NASCAR race car.
Whoa.
Death Wish will be the primary sponsor of Ty Dillon for the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series race at Dover International Speedway in Delaware on October 2nd. So race on over to deathwishcoffee.com and get your bag of the world's strongest coffee.
And if you go down to Dover, bring your coffee with you.
All right, it's time for our new weekly installment of your weekly sales agenda. Yes, you hardworking salesperson. I know the schedule is tight, but Jeffrey and I each have one thing we need you to pencil in or type in using your keyboard. We promise it will make you more sales. Jeffrey, what's going on their weekly agenda?
Your weekly agenda is actually your daily agenda. Write everything down at the end of a day that you need to do the next day so that you can sleep easy and not have to think about it or worry about it during your rest period.
Damn it, you stole mine.
Oh, well, there you go.
I was going to say, write down what you need to do at the end of the day in order to prepare for your following day.
Well, if you look at the Sales Bible published in 1994, you'll see that that is one of the closing tips. When were you born again? You were seven when that happened.
I was more than seven.
Okay, so talk to us about what new responsibilities can breed to you and how they can upset your apple cart in the morning, like walking a dog.
You know, it's all about the attitude that you take on with it. I wanted the puppy, and I committed to making it work. And waking up at 4 or 4:30 in the morning to walk the dog has been somewhat challenging at the end of my day when I'm really tired. But when she's crying, I jump up because I'm excited to do it. And I have found that, you know, Ben was talking about always finding the positive. Well, I get to play with the dog and love the dog, and that's obviously positive. But now I get extra time to walk and think about what I need to do and extra Fitbit steps. Thanks for listening to the Sell or Die podcast. We're back live next week at our regular time, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Bookmark blogtalkradio.com/sellordie and come join the conversation that's revolutionizing sales podcasting.
And thank you to our guest, the great Ben Prusky, our producer, Doug Branson, and our technical director, Chris Hill, have both worked their butt off for this show, fixing, editing, setting things up, and we are about to unveil a new studio that will blow the podcast doors into outer space. Stay tuned.
Until next time, I'm Jen Gluckow.
And I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, reminding you to get out there and sell something, even if your ass falls off.